This is Laura Waterman, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, reading science fiction. Today, we start with a story from the April 1988 issue of the Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction. This is How an Inner Door Opened to My Heart by Brian W. Aldiss. I found a walking in the sanctuary of the museum grounds, just pleasantly walking, strolling, as if she did it every day, naked, absolutely confident, friendly, anonymous. Where she walked, flowers sprang up under the imprint of her bare feet. We keep the grounds well guarded. Nobody can get to the six. Nobody has ever managed to break in from the tormented outside. Not one of our trees has ever been stolen. How then did the beautiful, anonymous A get in? It was a question she never answered. She appeared to know nothing, not even her name. How did she speak? It was always hard to recall after that musical voice had ceased. I know only that she spoke my language. Encountering her suddenly, I prepared to challenge her, but the words died on my lips. To meet a young, naked woman who greets you unsmilingly, without self-consciousness, without any attempt to cover herself, is confusing. The conventions fall away before that frank nudity. You feel humble. Whatever might be said would seem irrelevant. So there it was. Suddenly, the well-ordered world is mysterious. I had been dreaming of creating a banyan. Standing before her, I was the one at a loss. She came with me complacently to my apartment, to my office, and allowed me to question her. There she sat, relaxed on my mauve sofa, one slender arm upon the sofa arm and her legs crossed. She regarded me through her violet eyes, courteously telling me that she had no idea who she was or where she had come from. She waited upon my questions. She had no questions to ask me. She showed no particular interest in her surroundings as the daylight fell across her calm breasts and shoulders. How could I help staring at her, at those shoulders, those breasts, that lovely face? Through my mind ran questions I could not ask. Was she in some way deranged? Could this be part of a criminal plan involving others? Even more fantastic notions passed amid my thoughts, and what would the six say? Did not the arrival of A signal a crisis in our relationship? Requesting A to remain where she was, I walked over to my desk and rang security. They had nothing untoward to report. The barrier on the wall had not been breached. As I talked to the captain, I studied a reflection of A in a wall mirror. Although it was difficult to see her clearly, I could appreciate how composedly she sat on the sofa, gazing ahead of her without tension. Her dark hair seemed to surround her head like a nimbus. Undoubtedly, she was lovely. Almost too lovely, too perfect to be human. Her misty reflection seemed to fade and flicker at my thought. It was a relief that Stephanie was away on business that day, or no doubt I would be in trouble. Stephanie had no time for rivals. Since this was a Thursday, we directors who formed the six had an early meeting timetabled as usual in the museum. This presented a problem. I could not take A along with me, even if I dressed her in Stephanie's clothes. Relationships among the six were too delicate for that. Nor did I wish to leave her alone in the apartment in case she did something unpredictable or in case she disappeared in the same mysterious way she had arrived. I wanted her for myself. An intense yet oddly unfocused desire had seized me. A must have sensed my uncertainty. As I went over to the music stack and let Scandinavian chords flood into the room, she moved to the window and stood gazing out. It was how I afterwards remembered her, looking toward something unseen. I found myself drawn to where she had been sitting. In the pink cushion of the sofa, she had left the imprint of her naked bottom. I sank down and pressed my face to that perfect imprint. Ashamed of the impulsive act, suddenly furious with myself, I jumped up and left the room. She would have to do whatever she had to do. I hated to feel a woman's power over me, however much I sought it. In our museum, known simply as the Six, we housed reproductions of 52 kinds of tree. All were created in our workshops. Our rule was to work from photographs and paintings, and every tree was perfect in every detail at whatever stage of its life cycle we chose to represent it. The six of us, the six, that is, after Betty Jewell died, had been interested purely in the artistic aspect when we were making our first three or four trees shortly after graduation. A tree was just an art project to us, a series of moderately complex problems to be solved by the application of flair and logic, and perhaps with the correct plastic material. We might as well have tried to reconstruct a megatherium, but a larch had seemed at the time to present a more interesting challenge. Our first exhibition was a greater success than even we had anticipated. The public that arrived to view our six trees was impelled less by aesthetic considerations than by nostalgia. They wanted to see, to walk around, to stand under objects that had actually still existed on Earth only a century earlier. From then on, we never looked back. The very rich almost immediately wanted a The Six tree in their homes. We sculpted trees in all stages of their growth. We automated our methods. Soon, we were supplying stands of trees, copses, even woods, all over the world. All six of us became famous. Stephanie sang. I conducted symphonies. The great Aristo directed movies. Always we made trees. Some were designed to recreate various times of year. We never did generalized trees. They were left to our competitors. Ours were always individual, sometimes with blemishes on them, fungi, and so on. Once we created a dozen date palms in pure silver for the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Within 3 years of our first sapling, all six of us in the partnership were millionaires. That was really before the contamination laws were tightened. Since then, we stayed within the ample grounds of the museum. It was our castle, its doors closed to the outside world. The public was allowed to view daily, but only by Android extensions. The privileged alone had audience with us in person. We were three women and three men after Betty died. The sexual tensions between us were considerable. Lust and jealousy were like tidal forces that threaten to tear us apart, but the sense of a prospering and worthwhile project kept us together. Besides, who would wish to be at large in the illness-crippled world? Betty Jewell and Aristo Smith had been the one married couple among the seven of us. She was artistic. He could handle money. We all worked together in a big warehouse studio and were pretty poor in those days. When we had a chance to buy the ground floor of the building, we took it. We all moved in. I should add, we all got ourselves screened to prove to each other and maybe ourselves that we were carrying none of the killer sexual diseases circulating in the city. After 3 years of their marriage, Aristo found out that for most of that time, Betty had been having a secret love affair with Winston Watson Bulawayo. Winston was really the guy who started us off on trees back in college. A terrible showdown took. Aristo traded blows, though neither was a violent man. Aristo swore and emoted and threatened suicide, but it was Betty who actually overdosed in a friend's weekend compartment. She left a message saying she loved both men and could not give either up. A bad time, that. I fell in love with Stephanie Howe, who had been living in a mildly lesbian relationship with our public relations lady, Claudia Cadwallader. Stephanie was small, blonde, slender, not really my type, but she had something to offer I could hardly define. Gradually, our relationship became warm. Gradually, she could accept me. She was a laughing lady, Stephanie. Claudia, by contrast, was solemn and cool. After some time, Aristo, who was really the head of our outfit, took up close relations with Sue Mindanao, the member of our team I have not mentioned so far. Sue was a chemist, tall, slim, inventive, sparkling, often moody. She and I had lived together our last year in college, and a stormy time that had been. Not that we regretted it, and I guess the fondness we felt for each other was still alive, because just now and then we managed to sneak a few private, lustful hours together without Stephanie or Aristo finding out. They were all so jealous. Well, we all suffered for love. This Thursday morning, I was thinking of none of them as I crossed the path over to the main block. I thought of the meeting, which promised to be a tough one. Aristo had summoned our chief bankers because we had to decide whether to open a tree park in the center of Rigel City on the other side of the continent. I also thought of the strange woman who I have so far called simply A. Soon, I took to calling her Mary, not because that was her name, but because such a womanly woman deserved better than an initial. Claudia Cadwallader came out the building to meet me, linking her arm in mine. Like the rest of us, she was in her mid to late 30s, but there was something endearingly childish in her appearance, a misleading impression since Claudia was nothing if not high-powered. Not only was she our most sensitive sculptor, she also ran the actual museum itself, with all its administrative problems, as well as handling its delicate relationship with the fevered and near anarchic city beyond its walls. Aristo isn't here, she said. He's had to jet to Venezuela to see about that missing shipment of soybeans. I thought we had that all in hand. I looked at her sharply. It's the third shipment to go missing this year. She spoke in her normal, reserved way, which some found soothing, some irritating. But why did he have to go today? I said nothing else as we went up the steps, and then, we can make no decisions without Aristo and Stephanie being present. She squeezed my arm. Dean, Aristo knows that. Don't you think that's why he went off today? It buys us time with the bank. We went together to the meeting. Winston Bulawayo and Sue Mindano joined us on the mezzanine, and we entered the boardroom together. That's the way we always work, showing a united front, regardless of whatever our personal differences. There had been a time when Sue was fit to kill Winston. They had been living together, but Winston was making it with Claudia. What a fight! We had all become involved, and no one was speaking to anyone else for a whole week. Nevertheless, the six of us had walked together into a meeting, and together had staved off an attempt by Global Glutamate to buy us up. So after the meeting, when we had managed to hold everyone off on the Rigel City Enterprise — Rigel was a fine commercial proposition, but unfortunately its disease statistics were horrific and rising — we took a drink in Director's Bar, and I told the other three about Mary, my naked lady. A lot of jokes went by. We all laughed except Claudia, who smiled, but beneath it was a lot of angst. They were unwilling to believe me. Winston was jealous, the ladies suspicious, thinking maybe I was trying to smuggle in a pet without a health clearance. "And what is Stephanie going to say?" Sue asked. It was all fun enough, no worse than I had expected, and it ended with a challenge to me. They would come over to my place and meet Mary. On the whole, we had tended to keep away from each other's places of late. "Let's go," I said. The staff was taking care of public viewing. We could afford to have a little fun. But Stephanie's and my apartment was empty. I called. We all looked. It developed into a game. There was no sign of Mary, only the indent on the cushion. She had gone as mysteriously as she had come. Of course, I phoned security, but again, they had no report of anyone unlawful on the grounds. The others started on a heavy bout of teasing. I had to let them get away with it while protesting that I had certainly not imagined the lady. When they left, I sat down with a shot glass of whiskey and asked myself, had I really imagined Mary? Only a moment of weakness allowed the question to slip into my mind. I was a rational person, leading a well-regulated life. My artistic ability was never in doubt, and I enjoyed the respect of my peers. My career was a success. I skied once a year in American Antarctic. Above all, my liaison with Stephanie was a fulfilling one. Mary had been real enough for there to be a prosaic explanation for her appearance. Mary? No, that was a wrong name. Too tranquil. Madonna? Salome? Unusually for me, I allowed myself to sit drinking, getting no benefit from the alcohol, but enjoying the drama of the situation. I told myself I was waiting for Stephanie to ring. Stephanie didn't ring. I took another drink. I played my own music. Then I went to bed. On the wall of our bedroom hung a painting by Dante Gabriel Rossetti, the 19th century English artist. It was called How They Met Themselves and depicted a couple, richly caparisoned, meeting another identical couple in a forest. In these stiff figures, I had always found a disturbing quality, which reminded me now, as I gazed of them, of Stephanie's pained exclamation when we had been having a quarrel. Oh, living, Isn't it just like being lost in some damned forest? Just as if there were still forests, as I reasonably pointed out. More like being locked behind a door, I had replied. Now I lay down, and the doors of sleep opened to me. I seemed to be moving over a stretch of water, made dark by tall surrounding trees, approaching a mountainous island where a grand gate opened into the rock. It was in doubt whether I entered there. Before dawn, I woke, roused by sounds in the room. As if a dream continued, I had no surprise on finding that Mary was back with me. She stood by the tall curtains, pulling them aside just enough to peer out. Something in her attitude suggested anticipation. She was, as ever, naked. The pallor of the pre-dawn sketched in the outlines of her figure. Kneeling on the bed, I began to recite to her, to utter an incantation. Perhaps I was drunk, not knowing where the words came from. Your womanly figure with its full hips, your virginal body with its pale flesh, your slender waist and swelling bosom, that mouth with greedy lips, that generous flowing hair, all make me repent how I hungered for so many lewd conquests. Come to me, Mary. Come to bed with me and make me whole. It was like someone else's voice speaking. She turned, came towards me on naked feet. With an extended hand, she touched my cheek. I clutched her wrist. Yes, she was real enough. You don't desire me, and you must not have me. I am not yours to possess. What you wish for is my innocence, but I cannot restore innocence to you. These words, spoken gently, had a profound effect on me. In contradictory fashion, they filled me with both joy and melancholy, just as the situation, though totally unprecedented, had for me a haunting familiarity. I was at a loss to explain. I want you. I desire you like no other woman I have ever known. Come into bed with me. We'll talk, only talk. You know what you have lost. You must understand that I cannot restore that loss. Only you could do that. Look at the world about you and see its greed. See the misery that greed causes the greedy. You must not want so much. You must not want me. Her voice sank to a whisper. Terrified, I said, don't leave me. I want to understand what you are saying. I don't understand a word of it. Yet, even as I spoke, I did understand. She had opened an inner door. You must not seek to dominate me. I have a gift to give. As she whispered these words, so bemusing to my senses, she sank down so that her breath was on my lips. Then she kissed my lips. I sank back without attempting to capture her. Although it felt as if she was still talking, my curious state of mind prevented me from being sure. Never had I experienced such pure rapture. My mind filled with the idea that she had arrived from a distant saffron planet. Yet, by a ridiculous contradiction, the planet was somewhere near at hand, concealed. The phone rang, and by automatic reflex I switched it on, even before I was awake. The clear voice of Stephanie in my ear announced that she was at the skyport and would be back at the museum. She did not say home. In an hour's time. It was a bright morning. The long drapes at the window had been parted slightly, so she had been there and possessed corporeal being. A kind of lust and homesickness drove me out of bed and into a search of the whole apartment. She had gone again. Would she return? Had there been a finality about our conversation? And what on earth was it she had said? In a rather lost way, I heated a cup of coffee, showered, had my daily injection, and made my way over to the museum. The earlier sunlight had been swallowed in the city's self-made overcast. Winston Bulawayo greeted me cheerfully and took me to one side. "Hey, Dean, what do you think? I made it with Sue last night, just like old times, except, wow, that lady's so much more experienced now." I did not immediately respond. He added, "Well, old Aristo was away, so I grabbed my chance." For some reason, I felt depressed. I clapped him on the back, but could not help saying, "There'll be hell to pay if Aristo finds out. He and Sue were so happy." "Not as happy as you might think," he said, looking rather angry at the implied criticism. "Nothing's permanent. In fact, Sue is thinking of breaking it up and moving in with me." "How's Claudia going to feel about that?" He stopped and put his solid form in my path. "What's the problem with you this morning? You don't always be so kind of moody. Anyway, I've seen the way you look at Claudia. Lay off her, will you? I can look after Claudia and Sue." "And Aristo? Isn't he due back this morning?" The two ladies, Sue and Claudia, appeared on the scene, both looking rather upset. Winston's and my conversation ended abruptly, which was just as well, perhaps. He gave me a black look before turning to greet Sue. Inside, I felt deeply disturbed without knowing why. "Did you have a good night with your naked lady friend?" Claudia asked me, looking solemn as usual, so that it was hard to judge how seriously to take her. Before I could answer, she said, "Sue says that Aristo rang her to say he'll be back here midday. When does Stephanie get back?" "Soon." It was all I could manage to say. A chill suspicion had entered my mind. Excusing myself, I took the elevator to my office on the fourth floor. In a short while, I was through to our suppliers in Venezuela. They dealt with the growers who had cleared the last of the Venezuelan forests to grow the soybeans that formed a vital constituent of the plastic from which we made our artificial trees. Of recent months, they'd been having trouble with hijackers who'd stolen their products. They sounded calm enough over the air. No, they had not had the pleasure of a visit from Mr. Aristides Smith. I cut the link. Compelled by an inner pain, I ran down the emergency stairs and out across the park to the main gate, where the guard, recognizing me, allowed me to escape into the street. There I walked, pacing furiously, not caring if I looked distraught. There was no doubt in my mind that Aristo and Stephanie had met somewhere in a private rendezvous. They had spent the day in each other's arms, laughing, lustful, extravagant Stephanie, covetous, grasping, lascivious Aristo, the treachery of them both. At the corner of the wall that surrounded the museum grounds was a big video advert for our exhibition. It showed the six of us, all immaculate and aloof, being beautiful people, healthy, wealthy, glittering with success. Our clothes proclaimed our excellence, but under the clothes, I thought. I turned and pressed into the streets and arcades of the city, people everywhere, staring or not staring, many talking to themselves, a man on a corner in a black outfit cursing aloud, many of them women veiled, toting guns. This was the place we had nicknamed the Big Addle. Despite the warmth of the day, men and women were wearing gloves, all naked skin being covered as a guard against disease. Everywhere, forms slouching, running crookedly or moving hesitantly, anxious to avoid human conduct, the run-down Puritan world from which we, the six, had escaped via our success. And Stephanie had betrayed me. So upset was I that I paid no heed to the danger I was in. I simply had to walk and be away from all the calculating glances of those I knew so well. What had Stephanie said after her last abortion? "Dean, our lives take precedence over anyone or anything else. Our lives? We had no common life anymore. This was going to be another of Aristo's triumphs, demonstrating his ascendancy. Bitterly, I thought how little he cared about Betty Jewel's death, and she so tender. Well, no, really a calculated woman who had certainly been cruel enough to me when she had caught me with Stephanie years earlier. The crowds grew denser toward city center. There were queues at the clinics, the windows of which were protected by metal bars. Ambulances, flashing and blaring, made their way only slowly along the roads. "Chastity spells life," said the billboards. "Masturbation saves," they said. "Connection breeds infection," they said. Mary was standing naked among the crowds. She was looking here and there in an abstracted way. The crowds jostled her, yet curiously did not give her a second look. Possibly they were shocked. More likely, they regarded her as yet another government attempt to enforce the puritanical way of life. Anyone touching her would have been immediately arrested. As I tried to make my way towards her, waving and calling, she turned and went down a side alley. Pushing people away to either side, ignoring their horrified looks, I ran after her. The alley was empty. There was a church of some kind down there, advertising itself with a hollow sign, "The Church of the Deep Minders." Not a trace of Mary. I ran down the alley, looked into the church. She had gone. An acid sprinkle of rain drifted down. I sheltered in the porch of the church. Exhaustion and disgust overcame me. There was no place for me here. I belonged in the museum. I was of the six. I must go back and face the latest crisis. Perhaps we were all on earth to be tortured by our sexuality, that gift we had turned to such bad use. As I started back, a cop car snarled to a halt. The police jumped out and grabbed me. Despite my struggles and protests, I was thrown into the compartment at the back of the car. In short order, I found myself in a shabby precinct office, answering charges of indecent dress. I was wearing my usual gold lamé suit with my brown slippers and silver wig, my everyday dress, in fact. But hands, face, and upper chest were exposed. It was a violation of the laws. They were slightly impressed when I said that I was one of the six. Had I proof that I was Dean Morrisburg? No. I had no documentary evidence on me, but they had merely to ring the museum and confirmation would be forthcoming. So they put me in a cooler. My clothes were taken from me. I was made to shower. Blood samples were taken by a nurse in an air suit. It was afternoon before the police put a call through to the six. No, Dean Morrisburg was right there with them, and they did not know who the impostor was that the police were holding. My rage knew no bounds. So that was what Aristo and Stephanie were up to. The forests of their lust had sprung up and lost me. This was their plan, to keep me out of the way while they enjoyed the fruits of each other's body. Charges of contamination and impersonation began to look menacing. My anger faded before outraged feelings of anxiety. How was I to get back into the stronghold where I belonged? I put a call through to our lawyers as soon as I could, but from their stonewalling responses, I knew that Aristo had got to them first. A year in the slammer would be what I would get. Then they would have me back. After all, I was still a part of the six. 12 months was how long they calculated their passionate and eternal feelings for each other would last. Then they would let me back, if I remained free of disease that long. That night, in the silences of the noisy station, my cell door swung open, and in walked Mary again, naked, innocent, gentle of eye. She would not give herself to me. She uttered but one word, forgive. We continue with a story from the January 1988 issue of the magazine of fantasy and science fiction. This is The Highest Authority of All by Vance Aandahl. It was a raw November morning in the Netherlands in the year 2004. A sharp wind blew steadily down from the north, sending before it desultory gusts of sleet. The President of the United States of America stepped out of his limo and shivered. Hunching his shoulders against the cold, he opened an umbrella and tipped it forward to protect his face. The six Secret Service agents who surrounded him were all doing the same, holding their umbrellas like shields as they leaned into the wind and started up the steps of Het Loo Palace. Not exactly propitious weather for peace talks. The president was inclined to look carefully at himself. As he climbed the wet marble steps of the venerable museum, nay, royal country estate, he considered what he must look like in his black hat and heavy gray overcoat, with a black umbrella clenched firmly in both hands, and he concluded, with a smile of grim irony, that it was he who looked like a dour old Russian bureaucrat, whereas his counterpart, the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the USSR and President of the Supreme Soviet, the dashing Viktor Yusupov, was a handsome man, still in his 40s, who might well show up in a Gore-Tex jogging suit. No matter what his attire, Yusupov could be counted on to project a youthful and congenial image for the media. Still shivering, the president reached the top of the stairs. A door opened, and suddenly he and his bodyguard were out of the cold, enveloped in warmth and light and noisy voices as they moved down a corridor with anxious faces, shouting questions at them from both sides, while photo beams beamed and holocams hummed busily away. The president shut it all out. He'd already put on his favorite press conference expression, a wry smile that radiated optimism, courage, and wisdom. The people watching him on TV right now numbered in the billions worldwide. Not one of them knew he was really feeling intense despair, fear, and ignorance. Another door opened. He was in a quiet little room now, some sort of dimly lit antechamber. Someone helped him close his dribbly umbrella and peel off his sodden overcoat. He and his translator stepped away from the Secret Service agents and walked through yet another doorway into a room filled with art treasures. One whole wall was covered with a huge tapestry depicting a pair of larger-than-life medieval noblemen hunting a fox with whippets. Many smaller masterpieces from the Middle Ages, paintings, statues, triptychs, adorned the other three walls. A small round table sat in the exact middle of the room with four ornately upholstered chairs placed carefully around it. Yusupov and his translator stood on the far side of the table. Yusupov was wearing a red and green checked Pendleton lumberjack shirt and designer blue jeans, truly a new Russian. He leaned forward, hands gripping the top of one of the chairs in a posture that appeared casual yet forthright, and he grinned in a manner calculated to seem friendly and good-natured. The president walked forward and extended his hand. Yusupov reached across the table and they engaged in a vigorous, phony handshake. "Good morning, Walter," said the Russian. "Or maybe not so good." He laughed and gestured expansively towards a bay window, pelted and streaked with raindrops. The window panes revealed that the weather outside was getting worse. Perhaps the temperature would drop and the sleet would turn into a bona fide blizzard. Perfect conditions for a cold war. The president's low spirit sank lower. "But why should we be carping about it, the bad weather?" Yusupov laughed again, a hearty laugh with a hollow heart. "This time maybe we reach the agreement, eh?" The president had to admit that Yusupov's English was getting pretty damn good. They'd probably need the translators only doing the more technical parts of the peace talks. For nearly 15 years now, Moscow TV programmers had relied heavily on outdated American shows from the 80s and 90s, and as a result, there was a burgeoning new generation of young Russians who spoke American English well enough to consider themselves cosmopolitan and sophisticated. Grudgingly, the president acknowledged it was true. The commies weren't the same old glum, distrustful, secretive bear men of yore. In fact, if anyone looked like a bear, it was he, portly Walter Turner, gruff champion of the free world, a jowly, scowly old man all bundled up inside his conservative charcoal gray wool suit, like a bear inside his coat of fur. Without a word, the president seated himself at the table. It was time to get down to brass tacks. 4 days later, after 9 long sessions with Yusupov, 9 long sessions adding up to 33 endlessly repetitious hours of utterly futile attempts at negotiation, President Turner sat down in the same chair for one last try, session number 10. It was pointless. As always, the Soviets had played a tough game of chess, and for the umpteenth time in the past 50 years, a summit meeting was about to end in a bitter stalemate. There was one small consolation for President Turner. The talks had taken their toll on Yusupov, too. The General Secretary's facade of congeniality was eroding away. He sat slumped in his chair, his sandy Kennedy-cut hair mop badly tousled, dark pouches of skin sagging under his eyes. He glowered stubbornly across the table at the president. The two translators sat impassively off to the side, but when he looked at them closely, the president could see exhaustion and frustration in their eyes, too. Yes, it was hopeless, completely hopeless. The president decided he might as well say so. "Let's face it, Victor, we're wasting each other's time. We have more disagreements now than we did 4 days ago. We're still deadlocked on orbital lasers. You won't budge on squirm missiles, and I won't budge on polar deep ice testing." "No," sighed Yusupov, "not to mention our profound difference of opinion on the wording for the new bioweapons treaty, or the delicate question of what to do about Israel and the Sino-Australian hegemony. To hell with it. I feel like slugging down a double shot of bourbon and calling it a day." "For once, Victor, I agree with you," Yusupov uttered a raspy, humorless chuckle. "Except I would prefer it a vodka on the rocks." The translator said nothing. They knew when they weren't needed. The president gazed irritably at the big tapestry. What was the point in hunting a fox anyway? Did those Medici princes or whatever they were plan on eating it? Or making a pair of gloves out of its pelt? He shifted his gaze to the bay window. Ice covered the window panes, making it impossible to see the snowstorm outside. Cold war weather. He turned his head and stared balefully down at the tabletop. His attaché case lay open, sheafs of balanced power proposals spilling from it like the innards of some small animal they'd caught and gutted with a bone knife. The trouble with this whole summit meeting, Victor, is the simple fact that you just won't listen to reason. The president lifted his head and glared at Yusupov. We've offered you so damn many compromises.
Compromises? Do not joke me, Walter. Your compromises involve only the least important issues. Never do you give an inch on things that matter.
Things that matter? Tell me, Victor, what are the things that matter? Do human rights matter? How about freedom?
Do not talk to me about freedom, Walter. Your country has gone bankrupt. Half the people in the USA are living in poverty. What sort of freedom is that?
I don't follow your Victor logic. The president felt his cheeks burn with anger. The state of our economy has nothing to do with freedom or nuclear disarmament, either one. If you'd confine your remarks to the problems we're supposed to be solving, instead of bickering, Yusupov rose halfway out of his chair.
Walter, you're the one who's bickering.
It doesn't matter anyway, snarled the president. Even if you weren't so goddamn stubborn, Victor, even if you actually tried to cooperate a little, it wouldn't matter. These imbecilic peace talks were doomed from the start. Our problems are too complicated. They just can't be solved.
That's not a sensible deduction.
A third voice entered the conversation, a woman's voice. It sounded to the president as if it might belong to someone's grandmother, a cheery old soul with a tray of chocolate chip cookies and a pot of tea. But there was no one there.
Who's there?
The president swallowed hard and turned towards the translators, who appeared startled and said nothing. He and the secretary general exchanged a pair of deeply penetrating, "What are you up to?" looks.
There's a woman in here, said Yusupov.
His eyes bulged as he stared at the president.
You heard her, too.
We are not a woman, announced the voice. We are Pupu Marianari. Something materialized over the center of the table. Something so totally different from anything else the president had ever seen. Something so foreign, so alien, so extraterrestrial that his mind was lost for words and he could only gawk foolishly at it. Whatever it was, the thing looked like a tightly coiled ball of neon blue earthworms. The ball was about the size of a cantaloupe. The earthworms were slithering around at an incredible vision-blurring speed, but they stayed together in the shape of a ball, levitating a couple of inches above the tabletop and giving off tiny showers of blue sparks. This floating sphere of fast-moving galvanized blue spaghetti kept fading in and out of the president's field of vision, appearing and disappearing every 3 or 4 seconds as though the intelligence behind it was exerting a substantial effort in order to breathe itself in and out of corporeal existence. For a moment, the four men just stared at it. The president's mind was blank. Then he thought one little thought. Holy shit, he thought. You should never say your problems are too complicated to be solved, the worm ball observed in its kindly granny's voice. It would be more sensible to say you're too simple to solve your problems. The president was too stunned to speak.
Who are you?
Whispered Yusupov. We have already explained. We are Pupa Marian Ari, replied the worm ball. It appeared and disappeared and appeared and disappeared over and over again, like the mouth of some magical goldfish, the orifice of an ethereal realm opening and closing before their astonished eyes.
Poo-poo, where do you come from?
We, Poo-poo Marianari, originated in the thunder clouds of the 14th planet of a binary star system in the heart of the Horsehead Nebula, but we've come a long way since then. Right now, we're running the missionary concession in this sector of the Milky Way. We've been observing Earth for 8,491 of your years, but that's just a blink of the optical orb in our lifespan, you understand.
What do you want from us? Blurted the president.
All we want is to help you survive long enough to have a chance of attaining spiritual enlightenment.
Spiritual enlightenment?
That's right, dear, the worm ball laughed gently. We, Poo-poo Marianari, hope that someday your species will be illuminated by the truth. You intrigue us. Where else can we find a primitive, morally benighted life form hell-bent on parasitically destroying its host planet, yet also capable of creating the Brandenburg Concertos? You see, even though Homo sapiens is the least intelligent of the 472 species, we Poo-poo Marianari are licensed to proselytize, there's something about you that really holds our interest. Call it little unexpected flashes of spirituality. The president sat there at a loss for words, staring like a deaf mute at the writhing cantaloupe of neon blue worms. Across the table, Viktor Yusupov was gobbling at it in an equally dumbfounded fashion. One day you shall attain enlightenment. Because your intelligence level is so extraordinarily low, we shall be here to lend you a hand when you walk up the waterfall. Until then, it is our religious duty to stop you from murdering yourselves.
You mean, yes, dear. In order to save your people from nuclear annihilation, we have decided to intervene.
Intervene, said Yusupov. That's not acceptable.
He's right, said the president. We can't let you make any decisions for us.
Don't fret about that, dear. We, Poo-poo Marianari, think according to the principles of logic that are beyond your understanding. A decision that would be right for us in our enlightenment might not be right for you in your ignorance, so we have no intention of telling you what to do. All we intend to do is present you and your problems to your own highest authority. Any decisions that are made will be made by him.
Our own highest authority? Asked the president. Who's that?
12.5 billion human beings populate your planet, dear. We, Poo-poo Marianari, have found one man among you who is wiser and more learned than any other. This man is completely free of corruption. He is supremely well practiced in the art and science of jurisprudence. His knowledge is vast, his insight deep. He is a much respected man, a man renowned the world over for his ability to make impartial decisions quickly, a man you'll both recognize instantly.
Who are you talking about?
Demanded Yusupov.
Yes, said the president. Tell us the name of this Super Solomon.
You'll find out soon enough, replied the worm ball. Just trust me when I say he's the one man who can solve all your problems. Let me tell you how he'll do it. He'll ask you a few key questions that cut right to the heart of the matter. If you try to be vague or evasive, he'll demand a straight answer. This man brooks no nonsense. I can promise you that within 10 minutes at the very most, he'll settle your disagreements in a just and equitable manner.
In 10 minutes, cried the president. That's preposterous.
I smell trickery, said Yusupov. I refuse your offer to bring us before this so-called highest authority of all.
Me too, said the president. I refuse too.
Neither of you had a choice, said the worm ball, its voice losing just a tad of its grandmotherly warmth.
Come.
The president came. He came walking out of the darkness. Yusupov came walking with him. They came walking side by side out of the darkness into a large, well-lit courtroom. The president felt numb and tired. He'd traveled from Hetlu Palace to somewhere else, traveled through the darkness more quickly than he thought possible, and now he was feeling a bit lightheaded and very tired, half asleep on his feet. He and Yusupov came walking into the brilliant light of the courtroom. Vaguely, the president realized that one of them must be the plaintiff and the other the defendant, but he didn't know which one was which. Music filled the courtroom. It sounded remotely familiar in his ears, like the theme song from some long-dead TV series he'd watched 20 years ago. Over the music, he heard an announcer's voice specifying the particulars of the case before the court, and who presided over this court, who was the highest authority of all. Next to him, the president heard Yusupov grunt in astonishment. The Russian was staring up at the bench, his eyes wide with wonder and awe. The president looked too. He lifted his head and gazed up at the highest authority of all. "Oh my God," he whispered, "it's Judge Wapner."